welcome to the Vegocity Podcast for the 18th of February, 2013. The podcast that never puts off procrastinating. This is your host, Shane Killian. Let's uninsure the news of the bogus. It seems lately that school officials and even cops just keep acting against people for more and more petty acts that don't harm anyone. Case in point, a 5-year-old Mississippi kindergartner was grabbed from school and taken home by the cops because, get this, he wore the wrong color shoes. According to the school's dress code, the kids are only allowed to wear black shoes to school. Why is anybody's guess? It would be petty enough for the police to react to a mere dress code violation, but it's even worse than that. The boy's mother didn't have any black shoes for him, so she took his red and white sneakers and colored them black with a magic marker. But there was a tiny bit of red and white still showing, and that was enough. And the sad fact is, this is not an isolated incident. According to the report, Handcuffs on Success, The Extreme School Discipline Crisis in Mississippi Public Schools, by state chapters of the ACLU, the NAACP, and other organizations, this kind of thing happens all over Mississippi, and it's especially harsh against minority students. Quote, for every one white student who is given an out-of-school suspension, 3 black students are suspended, even though black students comprise just half the population. And according to the ACLU's program director for Mississippi, quote, the needless criminalization of Mississippi's most valuable asset, its children, must be dealt with immediately by school leaders and the communities they serve. Zero tolerance policies were originally designed to protect students from individuals who pose a threat on school grounds. Instead, they are being used to send children home for trivial things that should be solved in the principal's office. Here are just some of the other examples in the report. Students were arrested for playfully throwing peanuts at one another on the bus when one of them accidentally hit the bus driver. The kids were black, and the bus driver was white. A black girl was thrown out of school entirely for defiance of authority, which consisted of humming in class, and drug-related activity, which consisted of wearing one pant leg rolled up. One school regularly handcuffed children to a rail and left them there for hours for not wearing a belt. And get this, a student was sent to juvenile detention for wearing the wrong color socks. This is madness, folks. And this kind of thing isn't limited just to Mississippi. It seems our government is becoming more and more paranoid as it becomes more and more intrusive. And this is just a mild example. A much bigger one is coming up later. The Affordable Care Act and its related regulations, known as Obamacare, was touted as being the solution for the problem of the uninsured in this country. No more would people have to worry about losing their coverage, and insurance will be available to all. But according to a recent estimate from the Congressional Budget Office, Obamacare will result in an additional 7 million people pushed out of insurance. It all has to do with the taxes that individuals and businesses have to pay for not buying health insurance, or even not buying the right kind of health insurance. If they fail to do so, they pay a penalty, which the Supreme Court called a tax to try and worm it into constitutionality. But the projected expenses involved in getting health insurance, especially for many employers including small businesses, means that they will simply choose to pay the tax instead, and end up saving money over buying coverage. The result is that individuals and businesses are projected to pay $13 billion in additional fees to the government over the next decade. The CBO also expects the new provisions to cost the government $1.165 trillion over the next decade, almost 90 times as much as the penalty will bring in revenues. So next time, are you going to trust the government's promise? How many times do they have to be broken, their predictions fail, and their programs do exactly the opposite of what they claim before we start being skeptical of a politician's new plan to run our lives? Not only have we had to put up with the whining that Obamacare is going to do absolutely everything it's supposed to, just you wait, we've also had to put up with all the hemming and hawing about Obama's assertions that he gets to execute American citizens without trial. But now, a leaked Justice Department memo obtained by NBC News claims that lethal force against a U.S. citizen is legal so long as, quote, an informed, high-level official of the U.S. government has determined that the target individual poses an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States. Yes, that's right. Just one high-level official, absent any judge or due process, can just decide on his own that the person is guilty. He has to show no evidence to anyone. He doesn't even have to have evidence. He just claims it. The word imminent is key here. The paper says, quote, targeting a member of an enemy force who poses an imminent threat of violent attack to the United States is not unlawful. It is a lawful act of self-defense. In a court of law, self-defense is only valid where the threat is imminent. In other words, the person poses a clear and present danger and the defensive force is necessary to stop him. According to USLegal.com, quote, imminent means about to happen or occur. Something that is to take place very soon. Immediate. Unless, of course, the government feels like defining it some other way, the report says, quote, the condition that an operational leader present an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States does not require the United States to have clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons and interests will take place in the immediate future. It's required of you if you want to defend yourself, but not of the government if they execute someone without charge. Quote, we recognize that there is no private interest more weighty than a person's interest in his life. But that interest must be balanced against the United States' interest in forestalling the threat of violence and death to other Americans. Sounds like we've heard this before. Me lie, anyone? Amazingly, they even try to claim it's not a Fourth Amendment violation. Quote, the Supreme Court has made clear that the constitutionality of a seizure is determined by balancing the nature and quality of the intrusion on the individual's Fourth Amendment interests against the importance of the governmental interests alleged to justify the intrusion. Funny, I don't read that bit anywhere in the Fourth Amendment. My copy says, quote, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Nothing at all in there about balancing government interests. Politicians and judges just made that part up because, and I hate to be the one to break this to you, they don't care about the Constitution or your rights. To them, the Constitution is something to be maneuvered around, not obeyed for the protection of the people. The amazing thing about this document is how unashamedly paranoid it is. Listen to these phrases. Quote, may act in national self-defense to protect U.S. persons and interests who are under continual threat of violent attack. That the traditional definition of imminence, quote, would not allow the United States sufficient time to defend itself. Or, the United States is likely to have only a limited window of opportunity with which to defend Americans. Or, delaying actions against individuals continually planning to kill Americans would create an unacceptably high risk. Yes, there are enemies everywhere, and they can strike at any moment, before we have time to act! And they're everywhere, continually planning and plotting. We have to go kill them first! What do you think would happen to a citizen who said this? I don't think we need to speculate on that. We all know, don't we? It's clear that this administration is far more paranoid than even the Bush administration was. And a paranoid government is a very dangerous government. And remember, this only requires the determination, the guess, the hunch of a single high-level official, and then they can come and kill you. And you get no habeas corpus rights, no day in court, nothing. And if they kill innocent people around you, oh well. The question is often asked, how tyrannical would a government have to get before you oppose it? Is this not tyrannical enough for you? And if not, what would be? And now it's time to research zombie killing techniques to use against this week's biggest bogon emitter. And once again, we find we can rely on our favorite economic woo, Paul Krugman, to make us long for the days when Kent Hovind wasn't in federal prison. Yes, it's another column full of lies in his New York Times op-ed entitled Rubio and the Zombies, his reaction to Obama's 2013 State of the Union address. The sad thing about Krugman is, even when he criticizes Republicans, a party full of people incredibly easy to criticize, he still gets it completely wrong. Listen to the oft-refuted claims that he's still clinging to after all these years. Quote, in case you're wondering, a zombie idea is a proposition that has been thoroughly refuted by analysis and evidence and should be dead, but won't stay dead because it serves a political purpose, appeals to prejudices, or both. Folks, get your irony meters on standby, cause this is a doozy! Quote, the financial crisis of 2008 and its painful aftermath, which we're still dealing with, were a huge slap in the face for free market fundamentalists. Circa 2005, the usual suspects insisted that deregulated financial markets were doing just fine and dismissed warnings about a housing bubble as liberal whining. Whiskey, tango, foxtrot? Zulu, Oscar, Mike, golf. Excuse me, Krugman, but who was it that was complaining about a housing bubble? It sure as Sierra Hotel India Tango wasn't you! For years before the housing bubble burst, Austrian economists such as Mark Thornton, Robert Bullman, Sean Corrigan, Doug French, and many others warned of the housing bubble and the crisis that was to come, while at the same time, you, Krugman, were saying, quote, to fight this recession, the Fed needs more than a snapback. It needs soaring household spending to offset moribund business investment. And to do that, as Paul McCauley of PIMCO put it, Alan Greenspan needs to create a housing bubble to replace the NASDAQ bubble. You touted the housing bubble as a solution to the recession. Quote, every piece of this revisionist history has been refuted in detail. Projection alert! Projection alert! Projection alert! No, the government didn't force banks to lend to those people. No, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac didn't cause the housing bubble. They were doing relatively little lending during the peak bubble years. No, government-sponsored lenders weren't responsible for the surge in risky mortgages. Private mortgage insurers accounted for the vast majority of the riskiest loans. All of these are bald-faced lies. Clinton absolutely threatened to sue the banks if they didn't make loans under the CRA. Fannie and Freddie absolutely held 50% of the nation's mortgages in 2003 and had bought 25% of the $272 billion subprime mortgage securities in 2006. Even if we ignore Fannie and Freddie, we have the elephant in the living room pooping all over Krugman's Nobel Prize while he gleefully claims it's chocolate. The Greenspan Bernanke put. See, there are two motivations that are at play in a free market. The desire to get more than you have, and the desire not to lose what you already have. The former makes banks want to take risks in order to make more money in the future. The latter makes them skittish about taking too many risks. But when you have private profits and socialized losses, as is absolutely the case in the banking industry, there's nothing stopping them from running off the rails. It's a classic moral hazard. Both Greenspan and Bernanke, time and time again, reassured the banks that they would create liquidity for the banks if they got into trouble. They could be bailed out to the tune of trillions of dollars. Krugman is completely ignoring the fact that how people respond to the prospect of losses affects what risky behaviors they take and how well they restrain themselves from doing too much. He denies all of this while continuing to advocate for the very system that made the moral hazard to begin with. Krugman's bogosity, as usual, runs all through the op-ed. Quote, as people like me tried to point out, the whole reason our economy was depressed was that businesses weren't willing to invest as much as consumers were trying to save. Really? Is that why the savings rate is still at historic lows? And again, what about Bernanke's policy, again following on Greenspan before him, of pushing interest rates to the floor so investors won't make back as much as they'd lose through inflation? Why is Krugman ignoring history? Why is he ignoring Paul Volcker's reversal of this very policy in 1981, where the increasing interest rates, finally above the rate of inflation, caused the economy to fix itself in about a year? Why does he say, quote, Trying to balance the budget would simply deepen the depression when that hasn't been the case any time it's been tried, including 1946, where those very cuts reversed 17 years of economic misery. More to the point, why does he continually pretend that the time period in which all of this worsened, 2009 and 2010, were the years where his beloved Democrats had the White House, a majority in the House, and a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate? Because he just has to believe that the saints in the Democratic Party and his Lord and Savior Barack Obama just cannot do any wrong. And despite all the stimulus, despite doing all of the things Krugman himself said needed to be done, we're still wallowing in unemployment with no jobs in sight. But it must be the fault of those Republicans. Give me a break. It's classic dogmatic, us versus them, black and white, right and wrong thinking. Everyone who passed middle school should have eschewed that mindset long ago. And yet, not only does Krugman keep getting his nonsense published, he keeps getting the respect of many, including prominent skeptics, who seem to think that all those principles of rationality just don't apply here. That's more than enough to once again get Paul Krugman named this week's biggest bogon emitter. History is written by the winners, and so apparently is economics. That's why there's Liberty Classroom. Probably the best single learning resource for history and economics on the web, Liberty Classroom teaches U.S. history, Western Civ, and economics from actual university professors. There's lots of free material to get you started, including introductory lectures on all these subjects. And when you sign up, you'll get the full site's content for just $99 a year. You can watch or listen to the lectures whenever and wherever you want, even in your car. Learn at your own pace about the subjects you're interested in and become a more effective debater. You'll also get access to the professors via the discussion forum and even live video chats, all for the price of 2 cups of coffee a month. Use our special URL, libertyclassroom.bogosity.tv, and when you sign up, you'll be helping this podcast too. So bookmark libertyclassroom.bogosity.tv and use it when you sign up. Inform yourself against the myths and propaganda of our society. Visit libertyclassroom.bogosity.tv. And now it's time to take out-of-focus pictures of this week's
Idiot Extraordinaire!
In the December 10th podcast, we covered the case of Melba Ketchum, who claims to have sequenced Bigfoot's DNA. She concluded that Bigfoot is a close human relative that came around approximately 15,000 years ago and that the government should recognize them as a protected species. But because of all the problems with this, most of which we covered in the podcast, the reaction from the scientific community has been less than welcoming. Apparently, she's had trouble getting her results published. Gee, go figure. But Ketchum blamed it on, quote, "the worst scientific bias in the peer review process in recent history. It seems mainstream science just can't seem to tolerate something controversial, especially from a group of primarily forensic scientists and not famous academians aligned with large universities, even though most of our sequencing and analysis was performed at just such facilities." She refers to it as the Galileo effect. Even though Galileo's work was accepted by the scientists of his time and only oppressed by the church authorities. Hey, Ketchum, here's a hint. Take a look at your rejection letter. It includes the results of the peer review showing everything that's wrong with the process you took. You don't have to speculate about scientific conspiracies. And by the way, science thrives on such controversy, and results that overturn established science are favored by publications. If they're not based on completely sloppy science and bad methodology, that is. Well, guess what? She's finally got her work published. Yes, her paper, Novel North American Hominins, Next Generation Sequencing of Three Whole Genomes and Associated Studies, has been published in the De Novo Journal of Science. Wow, what an accomplishment. And what is the De Novo Journal of Science? It's a brand new science journal dedicated to publishing research in biology and genetics. In fact, it's so new, its domain name was only registered 9 days before Ketchum's paper was published. And Ketchum's paper is actually the one and only publication in the journal so far. Yes, according to GoDaddy, the domain's registrar, the domain denovojournal.com, was registered on the 4th of February 2013. And who registered it? No one knows. It was registered through a private proxy. Yeah, because respected scientific journals always hide the technical and administrative context for their domain names. Right. Is there anyone who doesn't think this lady just threw this shoddily designed site together solely to get her paper published? Okay, we've seen it before, but at least the creationists make it look good. At least they do a tiny amount to make sure it isn't blatantly obvious what they've done. And if nothing else, it's the shoddy, half-assed way this deception was undertaken that makes Melba Ketchum this week's...
Idiot Extraordinaire!
Well, that wraps up this Lather, Rinse, Repeat edition of the Bogosity Podcast. Please visit the forums at bogosity.tv, where you can read the show notes and join the discussion on these and other subjects. This podcast is free, but not free to produce, so please use the donate button at the top of the bogosity.tv website or down the right-hand side of the podcast page and give generously to keep this podcast going. And if you want to donate bitcoins, you can just use the bitcoin address and the header at bogosity.tv. And if you'd like to contribute to the podcast, just send a question, statement, news article, or rant to podcast@bogosity.tv. Put it in an audio file, and if it's good enough, it'll get played right in the podcast. Thank you for listening. Until next time, here's a quote from Carl Sagan. The fact that some geniuses were laughed at does not imply that all who are laughed at are geniuses. They laughed at Columbus. They laughed at Fulton. They laughed at the Wright brothers. But they also laughed at Bozo the Clown. The Bogosity Podcast is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 Imported License.
Bogosity.
Do you want answers to creationist claims against evolution? Would you like to know more about evolution yourself, or even engage creationists more directly, with actual peer-reviewed sources to back you up? My book, How Evolution is Scientific, is designed to show the basics of evolutionary theory and how it is so well supported using the scientific method. It's impeccably sourced, with references to the actual scientific material, and is arranged using the creationists' own criteria of what is scientific. Using their own arguments against them, see how evolution is scientific, but creationism is not, based on observations, accurate predictions, logic, and evidence. Get answers to common creationist claims, and even a primer on abiogenesis, the start of all life. It's all in my book, How Evolution is Scientific, available at Amazon and on Kindle, EPUB, and PDF as well. Get How Evolution is Scientific and never be taken in by creationists again.